I think most of you probably read about the Cedric Dempsey cancer run. And Isla found out that if organizations participate in the run, the nonprofit organization will get 25% of the money they raise. So the Poetry Center staff is going to participate. And we're asking if some of you will sign up to also participate for the Poetry Center and sign up to make pledges. There's a sheet that's going to be out on the refreshment table tonight. There's a 10K run. That's not for me, you know. And then there's what they call the 3-mile fun run. And it says that you can walk or skate. So I'm planning to stroll. And I hope some of you will want to participate. Isla says we will run in traditional meters. The student organization called Among Other Things is continuing its series that it began last year. And their first reading will be Saturday night, November 7th, with fiction and poetry readings by Karen Brennan and Tenny Nathanson. That will be at the Central Arts Collective, 250 East Congress Street, 8 o'clock. They'll have refreshments and they will ask for donations, but not a fee. It's come to my attention that the new Poetry Center hours are a well-kept secret, so I'd like to share it with you. We are open now on Mondays through Thursday evenings until 9 o'clock. So it's from 9 in the morning until 9 o'clock, except, of course, when there's a reading on Wednesday. We'll close at 7 then. So if you want a quiet time to read, come to the Poetry Center in the evenings. We've had a lot of people requesting to listen to the tapes from the early readings from this term, and they're all ready now if you want to come in to listen to tapes. Our next reading will be 1 week from tonight, November 11th. That's a university holiday, but we're having a reading anyway. And the reader is the novelist Harriet Dorr. She's written this beautiful novel called Stones for Ibarra, which is being made into a Hallmark Hall of Fame television film at Old Tucson right now. So we're very lucky to get Mrs. Dorr to come over and read for us. And then our last regular reading for the season will be 2 weeks from tonight. 6 undergraduate students are reading in the University Art Museum. Lolly Butler, Ann Heed, Harry Kressler, Kim Kuykendall, Kevin Lanou, and Holly Welker. And we added another reading in cooperation with Women's Studies and the Southwest Center and the American Indian Studies. And that's by the Navajo poet Lucy Tapahanso. That will be Friday afternoon, November 20th at 4 o'clock. If you got a newsletter, the announcement of Mrs. Tapahanso's reading is in there. Tonight's reading is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts and from a grant from the University of Arizona Southwest Center. Mrs. Winger will be at Rincon High School tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 in the library talking with students and teachers. And she will be at the Wilmot Public Library tomorrow night at 7, giving a general talk on writing, entertaining questions. Both of those sessions are free, open to the public. We first contacted Ann Zwinger. She said, "Why are you inviting me? I'm not a poet." And we said, "Because you're a fine writer, and that's why we want to hear you read from your work." Her books are A Desert Country Near the Sea, which is a natural history of the Cape region of Baja California, with Edwin Teal, A Conscious Stillness, Wind in the Rock, which is the canyonlands of southeastern Utah, Run River Run, A Naturalist Journey Down One of the Great Rivers of the American West, and Land Above the Trees, with Dr. Beatrice Willard. She's an illustrator as well as a writer. She holds degrees in art history, has served in naturalist in residence at Carleton College, and since 1982 has been lecturing at Colorado College. She comes to us from Colorado Springs. I hope you'll stay after the reading to meet Ann Zwinger and have some punch and cookies with us. Ann Zwinger. The sound effects. Thank you for coming. When Lois said I was doing a reading tonight, I said, what does that mean? I've never done a reading before, and I must say I'm leaning very heavily on Lois's advice, and anything that goes wrong, you may blame her. Anything that goes right, you may thank me. The only reading out loud of my own work that I've done is not my reading. When I wrote a book with Edwin Waitiel, he told me that Nellie, his wife of 60-some years, had read out loud every book he had written, and that's 30-some books. After he died, I went back and still go back to see Nellie, and she reads large sections, or as much as is possible, of what I've written for publication. And it has proved to be one of the happiest of relationships, because hearing somebody else read what you've written, you hear all the burbles, you hear the things that flow easily, and if something flows easily verbally out loud, it's easy to read. You can't do it yourself. It helps to hear somebody else do it. Anybody who wants criticism, get a warm body to read your work to you. All of a sudden, you see things that you hadn't seen before. You discover things that you wish you'd said, and you discover a lot of things you wish you hadn't said. In going over the books that I have with me tonight to read, I felt like that old show on television, Will the Real Ann Zwinger Please Stand Up? It was a pleasure to read things I wouldn't change. It was unsettling to read things that I would like to have changed, still would. It was difficult to go back in time. I'm a child of the present and the future. In reading Beyond the Aspen Grove, which was my first book, as I said to Lois, I try to be courteous, but there is a whole gaggle of, for lack of a better word, the little old ladies in tennis shoes who say to me, we wish you would write another Beyond the Aspen Grove. I don't know the answer. It's impossible. You can never go back again. My children were that age. The place was the place it was. I knew nothing about writing. I was fortunate in having an agent who was an editor, fortunate in having an editor who was a city girl, as I said this afternoon, whose idea of wildlife was the pigeon on the windowsill at Random House. If I could explain something to her, I could explain it to anybody. The passages that I'm going to read you from Beyond the Aspen Grove, one is the opening paragraph, which is what the agent read, whom I think was interested in my doing the book. And it was, we had owned the land for a couple of years. It demanded that I keep a journal, and I'd never kept a journal in my life. I have to say I had not written. I'd done editing, but I had not written. And it's odd that this place in the mountains, this 40 acres northwest of Colorado Springs, evoked some unknown something that said, this is a time that's precious and special. In fact, Edwin Waitiel wrote that nature writing is like preserving a fly in amber, and it's a lovely quote, and I will come to that in a desert country. But Beyond the Aspen Grove opens, as many times as I have opened this gate, there is always the sense of coming home, a feeling of belonging.
No matter that we spend only part of our year here, this wild mountain land is home in a way that no city house can ever be. The familiar vistas are framed through the gate, always constant, yet always changing. The gate creaks as I walk it open, and I unconsciously note the progress of the season. The rough-notched curve of the meadow, the sentinel ponderosa pines and Douglas firs, the vast stretch of sky are always there. But where there was snow last week, there is today a delicate pasque flower, so pale as to seem formed of snow crystals. Where the meadow was sere and bleak, bearded with dry grasses, today wild candy tuft and early daisies sprig the returning green. Or in the warming sunshine of summer, the magenta and silver green Colorado local wheat is in full bloom in the middle of the road, like Thoreau's flower between the wagon tracks. Or where there was a meadow ablaze with purple asters, there's now a foot deep. This land is a place of all seasons, for even in winter there is a promise of spring, and in spring the foretaste of summer. The white of snow becomes the white of summer clouds. The resonant green of spruce becomes the green head of Drake mallard. The gray of rock and lichen endures in the gray of lowering winter skies. The same orange red of Indian paintbrush borrows the blackbird's wings and stains the western tanager's head. Here, part of each season is contained in every other. The tight woven knowledge from all our yesterdays at this land is held in the stern simplicity of tree and sky and flower and rock, a certainty of tomorrow. The theme of home is one that I discovered today, runs through my work. One of the things that I learned in writing this book was about the small creatures. Having grown up as a kid who hated camp, I did really some fantastic creative writing at the ages of 8 through 15, trying to persuade my mother of the numerous ails and ailments that I'd come up with so I could go home from camp. One of the things I hated particularly was insects. That I have since become an amateur entomologist may say something for early upbringing. Although I may have started out early in the morning with definite plans to go further afield, it is simply too much of a temptation to stop and watch the ants. They cope with such tremendous burdens, dragging pieces of food as large as they are over log-sized pine needles and around skyscraper mushrooms, poking and pushing with such dedicated persistence that I, who complain about carrying wood for the stoves, feel like a sluggard. Often the ant I watch is yards from home. At leaving the nest, the ant receives the image of the sun at a point on its retina. By keeping the image in the same place as it travels, it manages a straight line. Like Hansel and Gretel, it lays down a trail for the return journey, a path of formic acid which you can smell through its antennae. I draw a finger across the soil in front of the ant, destroying the continuity of the smell path. The ant pokes about, probing with its antenna until it stumbles on the homeward way. Some hills are almost a yard across and half a yard wide. Pellets of excavated earth form cone-shaped mounds surrounding the nest entrance. These hills are inhabited by members of a species of formica, who make their passageways near the surface, burrowing deeper in winter to cluster in a compact, heat-conserving ball. Mound building is typical of Western ants. The orienting of the hill entrance toward the greatest amount of incident sunlight utilizes all the available solar heating. A glance shows that none are built on the opposite heavily shaded slope. Banding together as a colony helps to assure sufficient food, since all members contribute to the food supply. The social organization of a colony gives ants greater efficiency and even control over other insects or situations which might otherwise destroy them. In each colony, there are several egg-laying females. The first eggs hatch into sterile workers, fed on the saliva of the queen. The worker caste, as with bees, seems to result from an inadequacy of protein during larval life. The stratification of a caste system engenders a high degree of sterility. While watching the ants clambering around the hill out of the corner of my eye, I see a tiny drift of sawdust falling out of the bottom of a large log. That needed a comma. That should have been, while watching the ants clambering around the hill, comma, out of the corner of my eye. The mound is only an inch or so high, but tiny fragments of wood drop with hourglass persistency on the ground. The large black carpenter ants are also at work in the early morning warmth. They operate on old logs on which the bark is loosened, but the wood still fairly firm. Unlike termites, they do not eat the wood they excavate for living quarters, but carry each bit out to the entry, dropping it on the ground. They feed on nectar and must find a heady harvest in this small valley. Watching the peregrinations and excavations of the ants reminds me of Henri Fabre, an 18th century French entomologist and teacher whose fondest hope was to own a parcel of land where he could observe his insects. He made up for his terrible personal poverty with richness of observation and insight. He wrote a delightful account of ants over a century ago, and the tiny, tireless foragers of the forest have meaning for me because of what he wrote. Beginnings are important, but perhaps endings are more so. It's a tying up, a tying off, and a tithing. Trying to write an ending is the easiest part of the book and the hardest. I took a rock that was out from shore in the lake as a place to sit and see what went on all around that summed up this land as I had come to know it. We have tried to understand the patterns of the land at Constant Friendship. We have hoped to change it as little as possible. After all, we are only visitors to this mountain land. But to keep this mountain land untouched has meant that we have had to partially fence it, with a fence almost as much psychological as physically. And this seems incongruous, seems to be the only way in which wilderness lands can be saved. Only within the periphery of the fence is there time to learn, to understand, to cherish. My interest in this vast world of nature began when we came to this land with the finding of a new world, a sense of discovery, a sharing. But somewhere in the learning came commitment, the realization that in the understanding of this natural world comes the maintenance of it, that with knowledge comes responsibility. The late asters and the wild chrysanthemums bend and twist in the sharp freshening wind. Fireweed's cottony seeds skitter across the lake surface, diagramming the darting gusts. The chillness of the wind stiffens my hands and tugs at the pages of the paper so I cannot draw. An aster seed blows into the lake, joining a fleet of aspen leaves. Cinquefoil, geranium, and strawberry leaves are burnished bronze red. On the south shore, a few aspens hold the last golden leaves. The rhythm of their quavering is doubled to semi-quavers by the lake's reflections. The year is on its way to ending. It is time to go back, light the wood stove, and begin supper. When Beyond the Aspen Grove first came, two books are published. One goes to your editor, gets both of them, and being kind-hearted, he puts you out of your misery and sends you the second one. It came in the afternoon mail. My youngest daughter had just come home from school. The telephone rang. She answered it. And she came back and said, "It's for you, Mom." I had set the book down on the table. She had a glass of grape juice, and she put it on the book. I came out, and I said, "Oh!" And she looked at it, and she said, "Oh, Mom, I'm sorry. I was afraid it would leave a mark on the table." That jacket is my most, which incidentally was drawn at 3 a.m. in a New York hotel room. That jacket is my most prized possession. It says where my priorities are. The next book was a book on the alpine tundra of the United States. The third book, you're not supposed to have favorites. I think, probably is mine. There is a family feeling still in it, but it's a difference. My family changed. My children were growing up, going away from home. I had time to do things that I had not had before. The children were there, but in a different way, and they were no longer children. And this book marks my growing up in a way, and perhaps that's what people don't like, that there is life after Tuesday Bridge Club, and it's more fearsome than a four-note Trump doubled, redoubled, and not made. Run, River, Run made me conversant with living out of doors. One week I had 3 weeks on the river. When I wasn't ready to get off, I knew that something had happened. This book also has back notes, documentation, and a seriousness of purpose, which I don't think was there in Beyond the Aspen Grove. I don't know what the change was, why it was, and frankly, I'm not sure I will ever know because I haven't really taken time to think it through. I'm not sure I really care or want to know. What's important to me is to keep on working, to stretch and to learn and to grow. And Run River Run taught me that, and that's how I tend to live my life. Spare me the self-examination and the introspection. That's what makes writing a lousy business. I picked a couple selections from the upper river and a couple from the lower river because the river is so different. The upper river is a clear running trout stream. The lower river is a wide, brown, silt-laden, smooth river. This is up north of Pinedale, Wyoming. In smooth water, the bowman is no more than a galley slave. This is a canoe. But in rapids, to be in the bows, to be dripping wet, involved in more action than there is time to react to. In running rapids, the object is to keep the boat parallel with whatever current it runs in, and the only way to maintain control is to go faster or slower than the current. The first stroke not to learn for river rapids is the forward stroke, for this only impels the canoe into bigger trouble quicker. The rush of the current itself adding enough acceleration into disaster without helping it along. The most important strokes are the backstroke and two sideways ones called a draw and a pry. With a draw, the paddle is put out directly to the side of the boat, blade parallel to the gunwales, and drawn in flat toward the canoe. It pulls water beneath the canoe and the bow slips toward the side upon which the draw is made. A pry accomplishes the opposite. Neither is natural movement, and in practice, I add more water to the canoe than I do direction. In a rock garden rapid such as we prepare to run, ideally, the bow spots the rocks the stern often cannot see, draws or pries to avoid them with a nicety of judgment. For a vast displacement skews the canoe about, making it vulnerable to being caught sideways in the current, at which point the river makes a decision. At this moment, the canoe looks very frangible, and I wish I were back upstream reading about running rapids in a book. The penalty for hanging up on one of these rocks is a capsize. There have been times on the river when I have thought a good capsize was, quote, writer's experience. But when I actually confront this whitewater, self-preservation comes first. These rocks look like bone breakers. I don't want to lose my duffel or my drawing pads or my notebook or see paddles splinter or the canoe smashed. There are whitewater canoes with watertight aprons, but we are running in a standard open canoe that can ship large amounts of water, immediately rendering it cumbersome and unmaneuverable. Mathematically, in a 10-mile-per-hour current, which is a good fast rapid, the force broadside on a canoe hung up on a rock can be up to 10,000 pounds. The swiftness of a flip is incredible, quicker than one's mind can react. No amount of intellectual awe at big figures prepares me for the emotional instantaneousness of that force and its power. More apprehensive than experienced, more overreactive than precise, I miscalculate. The bow barely ticks a monstrous rock, but sufficient to break our controlled forward motion, and the canoe swings broadside against it with a ferocity that nearly throws me out of the boat. Water piles up against the boat from upstream. Pressure surges against the hull. The canoe hangs there, tilted, alternately wedging tighter and rocking loose, water rushing too fast and too deep for me to be able to step out into the stream. Why we do not capsize, I will never know. Perhaps it is because the canoe is loaded, giving it a stability that the lighter one does not have, but mostly it's because of Perry, who keeps his head and does precisely the right thing at precisely the right moment. He pivots the boat, we slip free and ferry to shore. I'm trembling so hard I can barely crawl out of the canoe. But running white water is like riding a horse. If you fall off, you better get right back on. The water for the rest of the morning is fast moving, but the rocks are neither so large nor so close together. The slope of the channel not so steep, and the water not too deep to stand in if need be. It's good running, great for confidence. I can see the rocks pillowing up in front of bouncing back waves. The rhythm of manipulating the bow becomes an elation as the canoe skims by easily and safely, rock after rock. As we swing close to the bank, a mallard hen springs out, followed by three golden tan ducklings that rock and lurch downstream in an effort to keep up with their mother. And I don't know whether I'm laughing at them, or just for the relief of not having capsized, or the joy of being on this river, this glorious, beautiful river. But all is not fun and games. Then the wind hits. Late afternoon sunlight glares off the water. The flat surface seems to form a suction on the bottom of the canoe, and it's difficult to paddle. Not only does the wind catch the canoe, but when the wind is against the current, the main velocity of the river is deeper beneath the surface, and therefore of less help just when needed most. My eyes feel like two burnt holes in a blanket. It's an old expression of my mother's. I wear my hat at an angle Maurice Chevalier would have envied, in order to block the low slanting sun rays, but I cannot keep the sun off my face, which is beginning to feel like raw hamburger. My hat keeps blowing off in spite of being tied on as tight as a garrote. In the shade of the overhanging willows under which we take shelter are mosquitoes. Disturbed from virtuous rest, they emerge screaming like viragos and take immediate vengeance. They infiltrate sleeve plackets, bite through my shirt, get under my life jacket where I can neither swat nor scratch. The life jacket binds across the back of my neck. The muscles across my shoulders burn with fatigue. The river swings right to flow beneath a 30-foot high sandstone cliff. On the cliff's shaded face are hundreds of cliff swallow nests, looking like short-necked jugs, pointing down at an angle, all full of young. Along this bluff, on the outer curve of the meander, the water is light and golden green. The suction on the hull breaks, the bow springs up, and in the cool shadow, it could be the beginning of morning. Anybody think I love that river? Brown's Park was a fascinating part of the river because of so much history. It was one of the places where Butch Cassidy used to hang out. It was protected. Posses couldn't come in there because it was ringed with mountains, and if anybody came, everybody knew. Nobody told. It was the real Wild West. Weather is blowing in from the west, thickening clouds tarnishing the silvered river. The vertical knife-edged bays of the Gates of Lodore now loom on the horizon, raw and treeless, brighter than the olive-green mountains. To the north, a single building stands on a low river terrace, Lodore Schoolhouse. A rough road leads through a leggy cottonwood grove to the school and the graveyard beside it. A large marble headstone marks the grave of Harry Hoy and others. The graves are heaped with big river stones, grown over with cheek grass and evening primrose, some fenced, some not. Some are identified with simple metal markers from the mortuary in Craig, Colorado, a metal frame with a stamped metal plaque fitted in, or a cracked glass over a slip of paper. Wind worries the grass. A once vivid fuchsia plastic rose, now faded nearly white, pitches across the ground, revolving to show its original color. There is a constant restless whispering, a snatching sound in the wind. The soil is pale and rocky and hard, laid under a wide sky and an unquiet wind. The building is not the original schoolhouse, where Speck Wellhouse presided over the bar at dances and Herbert Bassett collected guns at the door. Browns Park children now go to a newer school on Vermilion Creek, although this building is still used for hoedowns and meetings. Today it stands empty. Inside, a forlorn still life of pot-bellied stove, metal card table, and plastic spoons. Outside, a white plastic cup overends across the ground with a scrabbling sound. The hitching rack stands in front, weathered gray, where reluctant children no doubt left their transportation. I stand on the porch facing out to the southwest. The river shimmers below. The cottonwoods rustle. The gates of Lodore stand sharp and forbidding, but enticing. The river dominates the landscape, fluid, evocative, animated. How any child could repeat multiplication tables with this Pied Piper view is beyond me. The lower part of the river is quiet and lazy. Lots of Fremont Indian ruins, lots of time to get off and walk. One of the delights of a river evening, especially after chinning up sandstone and shale ledges and poking around dry, silty terraces, is a rinse in the river. There is a place below Turk's Head which, at high water, fulfills the requirements of privacy and a safe place out of the current. The water temperature in May is hardly tepid at 62 degrees, but the air is warm. There are two table rocks, firm sandstones upon which I can sand and safely submerge, letting the water swirl around me. In water that is so opaque, it is a matter of some faith to sit down. The current nudges but little in this back eddy, yet it is still easy to feel the erosive power of a big springtime river. The river sounds ear close. Seated eye level with the surface, I feel like an apprentice Lorelei learning the siren sounds of the river. The silt wells and fumes, voluminous and soft, just beneath the surface. It's fascinating to discover that by moving a hand just under the water, I can evoke all kinds of kaleidoscopic patterns. This silt settles out of a container of river water within 24 hours, but the remaining water looks like clam juice, colored by finer particles that do not precipitate as quickly in response to gravity. These extremely small particles are colloidal. Since they have more surface compared to their volume, and so a specific gravity less than water, they remain in suspension almost indefinitely, settling out only if they cluster together to form larger particles. Gravels in a stream may fall out in less than a second when the velocity drops. Colloidal particles may remain for decades. The Green River at this time of moderately heavy runoff is probably carrying more than half its silt load for the year. The average load held in suspension by the river is estimated at 19 tons a year, plus 2.5 million tons dissolved. The silt content near the mouth of the Green by volume was once estimated at 0.5%. It seems a minute amount, but evenly distributed by the current, it forms an effective screen, creating the year-round turbidity in the river from the gates of Lodore south. The sandpaper surface of the rock beneath my feet, unslicked by algae, provides a sense of stability in a flowing, swirling, moving world. How to explain the pure delight of being here? Some of it no doubt stems from the fact that after a day of unrelenting sunshine, almost any kind of ablution feels welcome. But there is an ineffable, sybaritic pleasure beyond the necessity. The cool slide of water slips down the back of my neck, down my arm, drips off my elbow, picks patterns on the river's surface. The water that tugs around my ankles is pure hedonistic enticement, issuing a reminder of downriver delights in a branch that bobs by on its way to other appointments. After seeing ruins all day, I'm extremely conscious of those who came here before me. So too, on a warm spring evening 1,000 years ago, someone must have stood like this, soothing calloused feet, cactus-scratched legs. I feel no time interval, no difference in flesh between those who stood here then and who stand here now. The same need exists for the essentials of food and shelter, the same need to communicate, to put down symbols for someone else to see, and so I cannot help but believe the same response to cool water and warm sun and heated rock and sandstone on bare feet. The last rays of the sun keep it warm enough to air dry. The sun hangs for a moment above the cliff. As it disappears behind the rim, the air cools, and yet it is not cold. Maybe time to robe and leave, but not yet, not cold yet. As long as I can, I stand, ankle deep, without civilization, without defense, going back to self, as long as there is yet enough warmth in the air to respect needful body temperature, so long as possible I stand here, submerged physically only to the ankles, psychologically to the base of being. Widening circles. My next book was a book about the canyons of southeastern Utah. Wind in the Rock is a funny book. Either you like it or you don't. The organization isn't what I would have preferred. There were five canyons, and it's bing, 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 five canyons. I would have done it east to west. My editor chose to begin with Grand Gulch, which is the Big Bang. It's a big canyon, well known. I would have preferred to have it in sequence next to the last as the climax of these canyons, and to end with the personal unknown canyons, the two little ones of Whirlwind Draw and Steer Gulch. I still go yearly as a consultant on sport yak trips with Wild and Scenic Expeditions. Sport yaks, for those of you who don't know, it's a double shell plastic bathtub. They are homely, look awkward, but once you have done a river in a sport yak, you'll never go back to a raft. It's your own boat. You carry your own equipment. You are on your own. You read the rapids. You run the rapids. If you flip, you flip. It makes you very close to what's going on with the river. And each year as we go by and I see the mouth of the canyon up there, it is just pure nostalgia. My life's blood is back there, where my being became sandstone and where the sandstone has a persona. And that's weird. I'm going to read from the last chapter. One thing that Lois told me was that I wasn't supposed to read longer than 5 hours, and I'm going to try and respect that. And so I'm going to have to do some quick editing now that I've marked up the book. This was my first solo. I have wanted to make one last trip back to these canyons by myself, but in this drought year, it is not wise to go alone. However, there's plenty of water at the foot of the Honaker Trail, the whole San Juan River, and the trail itself is just around the corner and upstream from the mouth of Johns Canyon. While I've walked the Honaker Trail several times during other explorations of the canyons, from plateau to river and river to plateau, this is the first time I've gone it alone to camp down by the river. I've looked forward to this time, and yet, as I sit here at the top, I know a tinge of apprehension. I'm not quite sure what I expect, and now that my ride is long gone, and it's too late, and I'm committed, even why I wanted to do this. But here I am, quite alone, and I should start before the sun bathes the whole slope, and I have to cope with heat along with everything else. Yet I sit a moment longer because the view is so glorious. It looks down the throat of Monument Valley from up there. The Honaker Trail runs down the north cliff of San Juan. The 2 inches worth of river that I can glimpse from up here are just about the proportion of water to land in this country. Across the river are tiered cliffs, mirror images of what I shall be walking down. Passage looks absolutely impossible. In 1904, Henry Honaker bossed the building of this trail down to the river. He'd gotten a permit from San Juan County to do so some 11 years previous, in 1893. Prior to that, he and his brothers had run a daily stage between Cortez, Colorado and Bluff, Utah, and before that, he lived in the Mancos area and helped the Wetherills run their cattle. Gold fever was in full swing on the San Juan when Honaker envisioned an access road from the river to the canyon rim that would aid in transporting all that heavy placer gold he was going to find. The first horse taken down the trail fell off the narrow path, and after that, supplies were lowered over impassable cliffs by rope. The anticipated gold boom came to naught. Only some $3,000 was ever recovered. The flour gold that was more trouble to sift out than it was worth. The trail is a formidable piece of rough engineering and cuts through type strata that are the type section for the Honaker Trail Formation, surely a kind of immortality undreamed of by a hardworking businessman with his eye on the dollar. I checked my gear one last time, a useless gesture, since what I don't have, I don't have. And one thing I've forgotten is halazone tablets, so I'll have to boil drinking water. But at least the river will provide plenty of that. I have full water bottles for going down, and I plan to eat lunch halfway down at Horn Point, a sharp promontory that juts out 30 feet or so toward the river, with a precipitous drop on either side. The view there is unparalleled, and the next best thing to hang gliding without the worry of landing. I have enough food to last a week if need be, and the usual gear of sleeping bag, mattress, etc. And it strikes me as grossly unfair that no matter what my size, I still have the same amount of basic gear as someone a foot taller and 60 pounds heavier. I reach Horn Point. First thing I do is get lost and miss the trail. And then I build cairns. Cairns, so I can find my way back. I reach Horn Point, where I intended to have lunch, sitting out on the exposed promontory, but the wind is gusting so fiercely that I think perhaps wisdom is the better part of valor. I am suddenly extremely conservative about reaching the end of the promontory. To get there, I must leap over a 3-foot-wide crevice that looks if it goes clear through to China. So instead, I move to the dugway on the north side of Horn Point, a formidable job of road building. Honaker constructed a ramp, a precipitous 100 yards long, by blasting out rock above and using it as fill material below. Near the top of the dugway, I sit on the limestone step near the top, and without taking my pack off, fish in the side pocket for a can of vegetable juice. Somehow, I'm more thirsty than hungry, but the warm juice isn't very good. Thinking to be protected here, I find it unpleasant to have the wind still whirling dust and sand, which unerringly stings me in the face. Below Horn Point is a near mile-long traverse going due north along a narrow, narrow ledge that drops off sharply, rimmed by a sheer cliff 50 feet below, and then who knows how many feet below to the river. I keep my eye on the path and ignore the drop to my left. Suddenly, a wave of nausea makes me stop, jolted. I turn to press the wall, press my hands firmly on the rock, and close my eyes until the nausea subsides. When I open my eyes, I get another shock. I can't believe those are my hands in front of my nose, splayed out, clawed into the rock, tendons rigid, fingernails broken to the quick, scraped, a fresh scratch beaded with tiny drops of blood, swollen from cut-off circulation from the pack straps. I recognize the hand shape, but not the dirt under the nails or packed into the cuticle. I read them not from the palms, pressed so close against the rock upon which my life seems to depend at the moment, observing heart and lifelines and stars of fate, but from the scruffy backs. Abraded, unladylike, rough as the rock they cling to, sunburned, calloused, and in them I recognize a different reality. I can go home, clean up, buff the nails, repair the damage, put on the lotion, make them look better. But these ill-used hands clutched into the abrasive wall belong to another place I live, where I am also at home. Another way of life whose isolation and quiet have become a necessity. That's a long way from beyond the aspen grove. Become rearranged very quickly down here. The most important thing still is setting up camp and making certain that I have drinking and cooking water, things one rarely thinks about in city. Since I have but one pot to cook in, the logistics of boiling water and cooking have to be worked out in orderly fashion. I fill the cooking pot with water for dinner. The contents look like coffee with too much cream in it. Still, I'm no worse off than the Mormon settlers who remained in Bluff in 1885. When they carried water from the river, they had to settle the silt overnight with cottonwood ashes. While I wait for the river to settle, I begin to sketch, even though sand occasionally drifts across the page. More than anything else, drawing sets me at peace with the world. Perhaps it is the intense focusing outside oneself. There are handsome things to draw here, such as the salt bush with interesting spine patterns and wide papery bracts ruffled around the seeds, and all the things I never seem to have time for on a long trip. While dinner cooks, no, nearby is a large boulder, just the right slant for a backrest against which I lean. As I take notes, a faint scribbling sound, just louder than my pen, makes me look around. A collared lizard, about 10 inches long, appears at the top of the rock, head washed with orange, black, and white. Head washed with orange, comma, black and white tan collar, comma, brownish gray back, tail about 1/4 of its total length, a striking creature. It perches on the rock just above my head, remaining there as long as I write, lunging and grabbing tidbits out of the air, head gleaming as if gilded, red-lined mouth opening and snapping shut, showing formidable teeth. Collared lizards are pugnacious and have teeth big enough to inflict a painful bite if caught and handled incautiously. And those teeth are generally in good fighting trim, since new teeth are produced throughout its life. Old teeth are shed in sequence in a complicated but discernible order, so that every other tooth is a strong new one. Because it is a relatively large lizard, it requires more time to warm up than tiny ones and risks a longer period of vulnerability before it's completely agile. It likely had a period of feeding this morning, shuttled about to keep its body temperature at the optimum in the heat of the day, and now feeds again in the warm of the evening before going down for the night. I have a whole list of things I'm going to do when I'm confined to my wheelchair, and this is one I'm not going to be able to do, but I hardly recommend it to everybody. Where the shoreline is webbed with tamarisk roots, I do not enjoy the flora. When I am an old lady and have nothing else to do, I am going to walk every river in the Southwest and uproot all the upstart tamarisks and let them float down to Lake Powell. To get in practice, I pull out 72 and cast them down the river. A useless gesture, since they will be replaced by 20 times 72. They are weedy, grasping trees that form ugly thickets and are fire hazards, and introduce pest that adds nothing to the beauty of the river. 8 species were brought in by the U.S. Department of Agriculture between 1899 and 1915, and now they choke small watercourses, and their greedy shallow roots and the dense shade of their thickets makes it impossible for native plants to get started. They have vapid blooms that non-Westerners are always oohing and aahing about, blossoms that ripen into thousands of tufted seeds with a vicious viability so that they quickly clutter up the landscape. No apologies to any tamarisk lovers. Sorry about that. Sitting here in the darkening evening, I feel a sadness that perhaps the time I have walked here has been a golden time of wilderness enjoyment before there were too many people, a time of freedom, joy in living in a simpler way that gives meaning to all living. Will those who come after me know what it's like to wake up in one of these canyons, hear the tentative murmurs and scratchings, feel the sixth singing sense of quickening heartbeat, of hunted and hunting, of life that shuttles and scuttles and plods and leaps, leaving tracks to tell who went here and sometimes why, and the wind erasing them so that it is only the cool sand that one ever remembers. Darkness comes so softly now, the cliffs seem to retain the last light of day as they retain the heat of the sun and give it back at night. The willows are in silhouette, but rose and tan and gray still glow on the cliffs. Silver still shimmers on the river. Stars appear slowly, only the bright ones, and then galaxies of lights flood this clamshell horizon sky. I don't think I've ever sat and watched for so long, hypnotized with the splendor of this time, this place, this sense of being. It is enough to know why I came here, to breathe in the solitude and the silence. I simply accept what I've been learning in these canyons, finding resources I didn't know I had, stretching, accepting that there are times when one has no options. And I sit here in peace because of that. I know that I will never be content without risk and challenge and the opportunity to fail, to know pain, the chance to test my endurance, unwarp my horizons, know physical stress and the blinding satisfaction of coming through. If the cost is great, the rewards are greater, and I sit here in peace because of that. And then, in the star-dark lightness, I shake open my sleeping bag and stretch out to watch the stars. A parterre of 10 stars lies in precise alignment against the eggshell curve of the canyon wall. They stand time still in poised perfection before wheeling on to other appointments. In the quiet, the air is singing. Widening circles. The name for a desert country near the sea came from Shakespeare. It's the name of the play within the play in As You Like It, and it's described as a faraway, fanciful place, and it seemed to me a very appropriate title for a book about the Cape region of Baja California, which is kind of a fanciful, faraway place that nobody knows. We had been going there since 1969, been going there about 15 years when I wrote the books. In a sense, I suppose I was writing it for 15 years. My kids kind of grew up there in the winter, at Christmas. We started going there because we got fed up with the Saturnalia of Christmas. I didn't like the commercialism, the stress. And so we just went to a place that was quiet where the kids could have a kind of family together, happy time. And I didn't have to keep saying, pick up your room. After dinner, I gaze at a beautiful, this is a fishing camp, a strictly male fishing camp. After dinner, I gaze at a beautiful sphinx moss splayed on the pillar in front of the dining room. Behind me, I hear the voice of one of the fishermen. You like moths, little lady? This is no place to see them. They spray with pyrethrum down here to keep down the cockroach population. If you want moths, you go up to the second story of the next building. And there they are, composed on the wall like one of those composite pictures of all the colorful moths or butterflies or beetles in the frontispiece of books about moths or butterflies or beetles, all the most gorgeous species on one page. There are more than a dozen sphinx moths. Although varied in color and marking, all are easily recognizable, medium to large moths with heavy torpedo-shaped bodies. One, 3 inches long, is rose and gray with barred wings. A bigger one flares its gray flannel wings to reveal underwing salmon pink of a small mammal's mouth agape. Deep yellow dots spotlight the length of another's abdomen, and it has a tongue at least as long as its body and comb-like bristles on its legs. One is a striped mourning sphinx, common throughout North America, a male with extravagantly feathered antennae full of sensors, which pick up the scent of the females. All are swift flyers that can reach 34 miles per hour, even faster with the help of a tailwind, in contrast to butterflies, which tilt frivolously through the air between 6 and 9 miles per hour. Some sphinx moths beat their wings so quickly that they blur. Their fast flight and high maneuverability necessities for those that feed only in the brief half-light between day and night, just when bats come out to hunt. Since they fly in the cool of the day, they cannot use sunlight to heat up their flight muscles. Instead, they vibrate their wings so rapidly that approximately the same amount of heat increase is generated as if they were in the sun. We were talking this afternoon about natural history writing and the fact that it is factual nonfiction. And somebody was saying, how do you get people to follow you along? I mean, did you really want to know how many tons of silt are in the Green River? I didn't want to know. But if you're there watching it move under the surface, it becomes a matter of great interest. And seeing all these moths together, it was just absolutely just blew me away. The aftermath of that story is that after I had captured and spread them, I was out camping on the beach and woke up with a heavy-duty pain. Everything said heart attack, and it's ridiculous. I'm not going to have a heart attack. But it got worse, and finally, the people I was with took me to the doctor, and I finally ended up in the hospital at La Paz with pericarditis, which is a rather rare and peculiar thing, which is all the symptoms of a heart attack, but it's an inflammation of the, not lining, what's the word I want, Lois? What's the around your heart? Anyhow, it's an inflammation. And I had a perfectly marvelous week in a La Paz hospital. The nurses work 12-hour days. They're 14, 15 years old. They were absolutely enthralled to have an outlander because they could practice their English on me, and I was thrilled because I could practice my simple Spanish on them. And Baja Spanish is like if you were a Castilian Spaniard dropped in Louisiana, honey, and tried to speak English. It's Baja Spanish is that much of a dialect. I discovered the second day when my stomach began to growl that everybody in Mexican hospitals is supplied with food by their family. And since I didn't have any family to supply me with food, they all kind of took turns. And for breakfast, I would have Jell-O, cornflakes, oatmeal, Fruit Loops, and there was something else interesting. It was all in cups. And you know how when you're in the hospital, the nurse comes in with your pill and a little white paper cup, and she says, hold out your hand. And you hold out your hand dutifully, and she puts the pill in, and she gives you a glass of water, and she watches while you take your pill, just to be sure. The nurse would come in, and she'd feel in one pocket, and then she'd feel in the other, and she'd come out with this handful of pills, and she'd put them down on the tray, and she'd kind of sort through them, and she'd take out the brown ones and the green ones, and she'd put a couple of white ones over to the side for me, pick them all back up, put them in her pocket, and walk out of the room. That made sense to me. I didn't have any trouble with that. The sea was a new place for me. I grew up in the Midwest, and I'm essentially a city girl. And a lot of time was spent in the tidal pools, and that was what my kids and I used to do. And we just must have really driven the tidal pool animals crazy. Highest up in the cracks are the periwinkles, neat little shells, pale gray, cross-hatched with darker gray lines, the color added in pulses of growth that give each its distinctive pattern. Many are only a couple of millimeters long, the largest not over a centimeter. Several dozen, make that several hundred, very tiny ones, waddle across the rock, spires ticking back and forth like miniature metronomes as they also feed upon algae in the cracks. Periwinkles inhabit intertidal zones the world over, receiving no more wetting than comes from splashing waves. Their operculum closes so quickly to minimize water loss and can be held tight for long periods of time. It is thought that periwinkles may be the ancestors of today's land snails and may be on their own tenuous trail to a fully land existence. Considering the problems a shell presents to a gastropod, difficulties in breathing, reproduction, getting rid of wastes, and hindering quick action, the protection it provides evidently far outweighs its disadvantages. The ancestral spiral shell was formed in one plane like a cinnamon roll. It was neither very compact, since each coil lay completely outside the preceding one, nor easy to carry, because all the shell's weight hung on one side of the body. Evolution solved this problem by coiling the shell around a central axis so that each coil was larger and lay beneath the preceding one. The spiral begins at the top, winding as it goes, producing a much stronger structure than a simple cone. The axis of the shell slants upward and somewhat back, and each of these little periwinkles cants at the same angle as it trundles across the rock. Oh, and then somebody said about the scientific background. I don't have a scientific background, and I remember the passage of trying to explain about internal torsion of sweating blood over that. I'll spare you that. Small hollows in the sand where the surf swirled around a rock as the tide went out are now filled with water. The most evanescent of habitats, warming in the sun, subject to surf on the return of the sea, never staying the same, coming and going with the vagaries of the waves, these pools are nevertheless occupied by a dozen small sea hares, which graze and lay their eggs here. The little sea hares are tan streaked with brown, given a ragged, untidy aspect by their ruffled mantle. In sea hares, the shell is internal and completely covered by the mantle, and this lack of confining shell allows them to curl themselves along the sand in a graceful manner, tugging systematically at each sprig of algae and then moving on. Their eggs float on the surface like frayed snippets of tan yarn. Even though they are exposed, they are little preyed upon, for they exude a chemical substance that causes other animals to avoid them. In the midst of these conservatively colored businessmen, there is one flower child, nudibranch, a shell-less snail in bright dark blue with yellow and iridescent blue stripes. It grazes along the side of a pool, very close to the surface of the water. On its back are two gray triangles like a bow tie, through which its heartbeats pulsate. Having no external shell for protection, they have developed other means. Interesting. There are so often things to be found on the beach. When they're in tidal pools, they're alive and wiggling. If you find them dead on the beach, you can really get to look at them. And one of the things that I'd never seen was a brittle star. And they're a starfish, but instead of the familiar star, it's a center with very linear arms, and they drop them at an instant. So the minute you pick one up, you got an arm going. I scuff a small brittle star out of the sand. It's the first time I've ever seen one both whole and quiet. A live brittle star is so slithery that examining it is out of the question. One often ends up with a couple of detached legs since they automatize so easily. I take it back up to my beach towel and fish out my hand lens to enjoy it properly. They differ from the familiar sea stars by having a differentiated central disc to which long flexible arms are attached, rather than being all of a piece as sea stars are. The mouth on the underside of the body is a little star set in a tiny granulated disc, now gray instead of pale green or brown in life. The arms are about 2 inches long and taper from a quarter inch at the body to a 16th inch at the tip. On top, the plates of the arms alternate between dark gray and pale gray. Three dark, one light, three dark, three light, two dark, five light. Light dominating toward the tip, dark toward the disc. The dark plates bear pale gray Chinese characters, as if the creature were bearer of ancient legend. Toward the tip end, all the plates are lighter with a darker pattern. The light gray undersides of the arms bear smaller plates, with darker gray stripes running the length of the arm. On either side of the arms are spines, a little longer than the plate they lie beside, groups of five toward the disc, down to three at the lower edge. In death, the spines are pale gray with a white spot at the base, tipped with salmon. As I hold the little brittle star in hand and take notes, it occurs to me that I can always come back to this time, these smells, these sounds on this page. I remember the reason Edwin Way Teal gave for writing natural history. And quote, "I suppose, if I answer truthfully, I would have to say that the first purpose was to preserve, as insects are sometimes preserved, with every wing venation intact in pieces of transparent amber, portions of our lives that seem especially precious to us." One of the things in the tide pools are the Sally Lightfoot crabs, which John Steinbeck in The Sea of Cortez, which is a wonderful book to read, said that they seem to be run in any of four directions, but more than this, perhaps because of their rapid reaction time, they appear to read the mind of their hunter. They escape the long-handled net, anticipating from what direction it is coming. If you walk slowly, they move slowly ahead of you in droves. If you hurry, they hurry. When you plunge at them, they seem to disappear in little puffs of blue smoke. It is impossible to creep up on them. Man reacts peculiarly but consistently in his relation with Sally Lightfoot. His tendency eventually is to scream curses, to hurl himself at them, and to come up foaming with rage and bruised all over his chest. Well, Sarah's husband picked one up. While he held her, I had my first chance to see up close the almost square shape and vertical front of the carapace. The triangular shape of the plastron beneath showed it to be a female. The smoky dark blue carapace was dotted with white, circled and splotched with pale blue, a lovely milky blue under the head. But she was not to be held for long. One claw made a triangle cut in Kent's thumb, and he dropped her with the appropriate comment. He said that the claw itself felt dull, but when turned at the right angle and clamped with the force of the muscle, it cut sharply. That day, Sarah sat on a knob of rock. My text, Tara's my youngest daughter. She's the one who takes a sip of cerveza, breathes deeply, and says, "That's fresh squeezed." That day, Sarah sat on a knob of rock, my textbook of invertebrate zoology on her knees, and read me the identification key. The night before, Sarah, who played Scrabble every day at lunch hour, had snockered me 150 points and departed triumphant. As she flounced out, she'd said, "All these years." How could she know? It gave me vastly more satisfaction than she gave her. And somehow, that added enjoyment to my saying yes, no, yes, yes, as she read the key. What pleasure that minute colony of humans, the only species to give and record names, sharing the accumulated knowledge of centuries, the sentience of sea and sun, water gurgling around our feet as the tide came back in, an irrevocable part of this time, this place, this affection. As I climb up from the tide pool, the slope above lies in shadow, but a shaft of sun still lights the hummingbird nest. It was a hummingbird nest in a crook of a pitaya, it was a distorted, the arm of the just came around like this, and she had built her nest right here, about that height from the ground. She is gone when I arrive, but when she returns, there are no more feeding forays. She sits facing the ocean 60 feet below. The pools on the rock shelf below reflect like steel mirrors, and the ocean filters in around the rocks between. She's nicely settled in. It's dusk, and I beam her my protective maternal thoughts and go up to dinner, having been reminded of how much I miss my daughters. When I check the nest the next morning, it hangs in tatters. Something got to it in the night. The black jelly bean babies lie on the ground, wizened and dead. I pick up a piece of the nest, so soft, so gossamer, fashioned of bits of leaf, feathery seed heads, fuzzy wild lavender calyces, lichen bits, all well shredded before being woven together. I know it's foolish and sentimental, but I hold that poor scrap of a nest in my hands and tears blur my eyes. I wonder if she is still alive, still hovering somewhere, if she will nest next spring, will haunt the San Miguel vine, will lay pea-sized eggs, if she will gargle the air with her flight and remind me of the tenuousness of motherhood. The book begins in the mountains and it ends in the sea. On October 25th, 1764, Miguel del Bargo, Jesuit missionary, wrote to his father, procurator, saying, "My natural inclination leads me completely away from the sea." Yes, watch my lips. Freshwater child, raised on a river, summered on a lake in Michigan, I am firmly bonded to the freshwater heritage imprinted on me since birth. In addition, I inherited a predisposition towards seasickness. It is my further opinion that salt water tastes terrible and waves make swimming a lot of unnecessary effort. I know exactly what the first fish that scooped itself out of the sea and up onto dry land and decided to stay thought as it slithered from the murky shallows on its tender finny feet and felt the whispery air. Enough of this vertiginous slosh. Enough of this flowing and ebbing. Enough of this salt water in my eyes. Give me a stable base from which to operate and a firm horizon on which to lock. Therefore, not until a few years ago could I be talked into snorkeling. Herman smeared my face mask with something he called whale spit to keep my mask from fogging. Jonah didn't like it, and neither did I. It made my eyes smart, and I had to wipe it out and find something less irritating. Finally, Susan, my water child, took me firmly by the hand, saying kindly, "Come on, Mom," in that tone of voice one assumes with a recalcitrant child, and trapped me with her patience. Because the water was not terribly warm, I borrowed Susan's wetsuit. Susan is taller than I, and her wetsuit fit me like Dolly Parton's would fit olive oil. I was so buoyant, I bobbed like a cork. Once in, I had trouble keeping my flippers on. The foot extension necessary for flippers gave me foot cramps. A grain of sand lodged in one flipper. It stuck at a bony place, and as I worked it out with my fingers, I let the snorkel tube dip below the surface. Even worse, beneath me was a whole moving world of vertiginous flickering light jiggling on wave-rippled sands, rocks wavering uncertainly, tufts of algae wafting about without apparent direction. The water went up and down, the patterns on the bottom swayed back and forth, and the fish rotated at cross purposes to it all. When I finally dragged myself out, my stomach and head were so seriously uncoupled, my eye and ear so disoriented, I seriously considered taking Dramamine the next time I tried this, which I trusted would not be again soon. A summer passed, time in which to forget. Once again, I set out, this time with my own wetsuit. Visibility was excellent. Interlocking lozenges of light scampered up the rocks, fell off, coalesced, shredded in a scintillating display of northern lights in an aqueous sky. A thin line turned, flashed into a fish. A foreshortened view slewed into profile. Tail gleamed, flank pressed against water, head turned, gill flared, fish swam. Swift play of light, quick intensity of color, shine of scales and glow of iridescence. The curved flanks of silvery slivers, constantly turning and tumbling, rearranging like a pastel kaleidoscope. The interface of water and air, a boundary I'd only seen from above, was a silken tent, undulating in the underwater wind, gray-blue with moving ovals, a scrim through which light billowed. A small fish shinning up to the surface popped the film and slid back down again, all in silence. I was hooked. Now, one of the things I learned from teaching my students at Colorado College in natural history class was that you often bury your beginnings and ends in odd places. I have known for a long time that when I write a paragraph, I have one throwaway sentence and I begin the paragraph with a second sentence. So it's just a matter of going through and editing. So it should not have come as a surprise that the real ending, not only to Run River Run, but to anything I have ever written, comes not at the end of the book, but at the end of chapter 13 in Run River Run. And it's a better ending than what the book ends with. Remember, you heard it here first. When I read it again this morning, I had a seldom felt sense of, I wish I'd written that. I walk away from the lookout and face upriver. Even with a group, it's possible to have a great deal of time alone with the river. I sit on the edge of the Chinle parapet and dangle my feet over the side. It occurs to me somewhat vaguely that I, who am normally afraid of heights, am sitting comfortably above a large segment of empty space. The cottonwoods below follow the river's curve in an esker of green. The river is brown, and the clanking hot shale beneath my hand is gray-green. I should be writing or drawing, recording, but I can only ponder, feeling immobilized by the weight of the sunlight on my back. Rock, tree, sky, a hand shadow on the page, a morning breeze, a sunlight-webbed river. I suppose it is the proportions that count. How much is stone, strong, how much is green, yielding, and how much is river, going on and never coming back.